All right, so topic tonight, what's so great about the present moment? What's so great about the present moment? Anybody have any ideas before I even start?
It's real.
It's real.
It's all we've got.
It's all we got.
Keeps me out of the future.
Keeps me out of the future, okay.
Less anxiety.
Less anxiety, good. How many of you are always in the present? So you can reap all these benefits. It's not easy to do, so that's what we're going to talk about. And you've all heard the admonitions, stay present, bear awareness, be here now. It goes on and on and on. And I don't know about you, but for me, it was like, why can't I do this? For so long, it was, if this is so important, why can't I do this? Why is it so emphasized when it's so difficult? And I love doing these talks because I get to research and see what other teachers have to say and, you know, just different ideas on the topic. And the Tibetans have an idea of why it is so difficult. And I appreciate their take on it. And they said, because time moves so quickly, and that slice of time is so small that you're in the present, that it's, they say, impossible to be there. So their formula is to be in the present, to be in the past, and be in the future all at the same time. So and they call that being in the now, in the vernacular. I don't know what it is in the Tibetan, but instead of present, being now, just being here now. When I Asanta Chitta and I are teaching, and at the end of the month, we'll be going more into this. But I wanted to show you something, which is one of the reasons I wanted you close. All right. So here's a picture. Look at it carefully and tell me what it is. Mm-hmm. A bird flying? Is that what you see?
Yeah.
A bird flying. Okay.
I know there's a trick.
No trick. In the Tibetan universe, this is a picture of the sky, and that's being present, because you're seeing everything, the future, the past, and now, everything that's in this picture. Very few people say, I see the sky and a bird, but that's what's going on. And that's what we're trying to do, to have a bigger, more spacious idea of what's taking place. So, as I mentioned, Tibetans say that we should be in this very spacious place of the past, present, and the future. In this practice, we take a different approach. Anybody want to summarize what this practice's approach is? What? Well, we are in moment-to-moment awareness, as Margaret just said. That's what we're watching constantly, is the changing of things. There is no present. There is only constant change, and seeing, that's what the present is. Moment-to-moment awareness. You've all heard that many, many times. But when you think about it, it really sinks in. There is no present you can stick to. You can only watch change going on endlessly. This is not an easy concept at all. And I think one of the reasons a lot of people give up on this practice is because they don't get that concept. I'm trying to be present and I can't do it. Well, no, you can't do it. It's impossible. But you can watch moment-to-moment awareness. And we're going to go into some other techniques. You've all heard the tried-and-true ones. There's a couple other ones that I want to toss out that I've been working with and are interesting. And so if we can't understand something, and if we don't understand what the present is, what happens? We stop. We give up. I can't do this. How many times have you said that? I can't do this. When we have the beginning meditation class, you know, very few people continue. Very few people actually come to Sangha and continue a practice. It's hard. It's hard being, quote, present. It's hard being in the now. And then doubt starts taking place. The insidious doubt. Now remember, there's two kinds of doubt. There's skillful doubt and there's suffering doubt. Skillful doubt is what we should be looking at. That's where the Pali saying, ayipasako, comes from. Try this out for yourself. And that's what we should be doing. Looking at different ways of being here now and finding out what works for us. I've talked about this book that Stephen Batchelor wrote, and it was called The Faith to Doubt. I think it's one of the best books I've ever read. And it was when he was a Korean Zen monk, and he went on a 3-month retreat. And the retreat was all based on doubt. And they were cultivating three aspects: great faith, great courage, great doubt. And they said, if you don't doubt and start experimenting yourself and looking at what you doubt, you're never going to get ahead. And so their saying is, the Chinese Chan saying is, great doubt, great enlightenment; little doubt, little enlightenment; no doubt, no enlightenment. So there's no problem with doubting and wondering, where is the present? How do I do this? What's going on? Question and start looking and start experimenting. Unskillful doubt, on the other hand, is doubting the way life is. Doubting that there's causes and conditions for everything. I'll put it in the aspect of, I like putting things in ways I can understand. Climate change. Climate change is not happening. Somebody might say that. That to me is suffering doubt, because they're going to allow to continue what is causing the fires that are going on, the devastation, the floods. My youngest son just moved to Michigan, and 2 days after he moved into his new house, they had a 1,000-year flood. You might have seen it on the news. Agate Street is the street he lived on, and it was completely wiped out. Half the town was wiped out. They said, this never happens. So somebody to doubt climate change and things are... that's suffering doubt, and it not only causes suffering for the person, it's causing suffering for all sentient beings. And that's why it is called suffering doubt. And maybe your doubt is, why can't I get good things to happen when I try so hard to stay present? Anybody think that? So, how many of you have heard, when you place your full attention, and I'm just going to use present moment because that's what we use, but it's really changing constantly. If you could stay there, things would be so much more beautiful. You'd see things in a completely different way. Life would be easier. How many of you heard that? Yeah? Only one? Oh, I heard it. No trick question here. This is certainly part of the secular mindfulness movement now. And I'm not putting down the secular mindfulness movement, believe me. And I'll get to what I'm getting to. But that's part of it. If you can just stay present, well, remember the raisin exercise, those of you who have gone through a beginning meditation class, and how much sweeter it tastes? Okay, it does. There's no problem with that. But that's not the reason we're practicing. And I'm going to go into that too. It's true that with concentration, you will have some really wonderful experiences. But like everything else, they come and they go. They don't last. Some of you who have been over to my house for dinner, I don't allow you to do dishes. I don't have a dishwasher, and I don't allow people to do dishes because I had an enlightening experience doing dishes once. And I still grasp at maybe this time, maybe this time, maybe this time.
Seems a little selfish.
What can I say? But according to the Buddha, this is not why we are practicing, to have these kind of satori kind of experiences. I promise you I have a prison story. So one of the prison sanghas about 2 years ago, a young man came in. This was a very mature sangha that had been meeting for a couple of years, and we were all practicing for maybe, you know, sitting for 30, 35 minutes. And this young person came in, and I just thought, well, this isn't going to work. He's going to sit here for 35 minutes, and just as we were talking about, it's so hard to be in the present, he's going to leave and we'll never see him again, and that's just the way it is. And so we sat down, and everything was quiet. He didn't fidget or anything. I was surprised, rang the bell, and we always do a check-in afterwards. You know, how was your sitting? What came up? What was difficult? And this guy says, I'm in bliss. I can't believe it. So this is what meditation is. Oh my God. Oh, I'm enlightened. And I just thought, oh God, no. This is gonna be bad. You know, if any of you are cursed with a first good sitting, you know what I'm talking about.
Beginner's luck.
Huh? Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, you never know when you might drop into that. He just happened to drop into this, and he was on cloud nine. I'll be back. This is great. I love this. And he came back, and you know what happened. He had a horrible sitting. He thought he was just going to go into this magical, blissful state of samadhi, and it didn't happen. And he lasted about 5 weeks, and then we never saw him again. So this is why the Buddha said those kind of things, they can be lovely. That's not the point of practice. They come and they go, like everything else. So a question, what do you think changed for this inmate? Why did he not come back? What was so difficult for him? Mm-hmm. Right, that's right. He had a pleasurable experience, and he wanted more of that. Attachment. Attachment, desire. Not a good thing. Not a good way to get liberated. This is a quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi. Though we may initially take up meditation with an open and explorative mind, at a certain point in our practice, we inevitably arrive at a crossroads where we're faced with a choice. Either we can continue the meditation as a purely naturalistic, non-religious discipline, or we can transpose the practice back into its original setting of Buddhist faith and understanding. If we choose the first route, we might still deepen our meditation and reap more abundantly the same benefits we have obtained so far. Deeper calm, more equanimity, greater openness, even a kind of penetration of the here and now. Nevertheless, As desirable as these fruits might be in themselves, viewed against the Buddha's word, they remain incomplete. When practiced against the background of a naturalistic understanding, insight meditation can bring greater calm, understanding, and equanimity, even experiences of insight. It can purify the mind of the coarser defilements and issue in a tranquil acceptance of life's vicissitudes. For these reasons, this mode of practice should not be disparaged. However, from a deeper point of view, this appropriation of Buddhist meditation remains incomplete. It is still confined to the sphere of conditioned existence, still tied to the cycle of karma and its fruit. So can you understand that and what he is talking about? So again, desire is the culprit. Desire of I want it this way, desire I don't want it this way. And it's why we get discouraged. It's why that inmate got discouraged. He wanted it a certain way. Thoughts come and go, emotions come and go, everything comes and goes. This is our practice, watching that and seeing if we can begin eliminating desire to hold on to the pleasurable and the desire to rid ourselves of the unpleasurable. The truth about life is we have both. We would not know the desirable if the undesirable wasn't there. Just think about it. We would just be in neutral all the time. This is life. It's the beauty of life, and it's the perplexity of life. So the Buddha said, the reason we practice is to uproot the reason for desire. Why are we desiring this so much? And the only way we can start uprooting desire is being in the present moment. It's the only place. So as hard as it is, as the Tibetan said, being in the now, this is what we have to practice, because there's no other place to uproot it. We have to be here. We have to see what's going on. You remember Jill Bolton Taylor, who had the stroke? She had this feeling of, the Buddha calls it unconditioned happiness. Happiness that doesn't depend on anything. No sensory input. It's the deepest sort of happiness. And just to remind you, she had a stroke, I think when she was in her early 30s, and lost use of the left side of her brain. So all the chatter, all the past, all the future was gone. All she had was the present. So this is to quote from her. Because I could no longer identify the boundaries of my body, I felt enormous and expansive. I felt at one with all the energy that was, and it was beautiful there. She refers to this as la-la land. Imagine, to quote her, imagine what it would be like to be totally disconnected to your brain chatter that connects you to the external world. I felt lighter in my body. I felt the sense of peacefulness. Imagine what it would be like to lose 37 years of emotional baggage. And that's what she experienced. That is unconditioned happiness. And fortunately or unfortunately, she had a stroke to realize it. So most of us don't practice like this. I don't mean strokes. I mean we're not practicing for complete liberation, frankly. Most of us aren't. Very few people are. We're practicing for the mundane state that Bhikkhu Bodhi talked about, where we have ease of living, things are a little bit easier, our relationships are easier, and we're a bit more comfortable. Frankly, that's why we do it. Otherwise, we'd probably be monastics or we'd be doing 3 and 4 year long retreats. So there's nothing wrong with that. And to come full circle, even with our mundane practice, which I believe most of us are at, we have to be present. We still have to be present. So how do we stay present? How do we stay in this moment? The real quick answer, and I won't use this, but I'll just say quickly, the Noble Eightfold Path. It includes everything in your life. And if you're serious about practice, you know the Noble Eightfold Path so well. I have on my phone, I have a kind of fun text thing going with two former inmates. We call them returning citizens. They both live in LA. And we just have, you know, sharing stuff. And one guy yesterday put up a little cheat sheet of the Noble Eightfold Path, and he said, don't ever forget this to the other guy. That's how important it is to them, and how much time we spend on that in prison. So how do we stay in the present moment? Noble Eightfold Path will take us there. Mindfulness of the body. We all know this. Mindfulness of the body, feeling the touch points of the body, sitting on a chair on the cushion, feeling the breath coming in and out. Mala beads. I'm a big supporter of mala beads. You start spinning out of control and just can't get rid of your story. Just sit there and feel wood, and it will bring you back. And everybody has their own techniques. It's the body. Whatever works for you to bring you back, to bring you back to just seeing the constant changing of everything. Use the body. Here's a quote from the Buddha. It would be better, bhikkhus, for the uninstructed worldling to take as self, this self, the body, rather than the mind. Does that surprise you? There is no permanent self, but he said if you're going to take one, use the body, your mind, forget that. That's no self. For what reason? The body is seen standing for 1 year, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, maybe even 100 years. But that which is called the mind or consciousness, by day and by night, arises as one thing and ceases as another. Just as a monkey roaming through a forest grabs hold of one branch, lets go and grabs another, then lets go and grabs another, so too does the mind, by day and night, arising as one thing and ceasing as another. So this is why the body is so important. And, you know, you've all heard the instructions. I've certainly given them a million times. Go to the body. The body cannot be in the past. It can't be in the future. Your body can only be here, right now. That's it. This is as close as we're going to get to being in the present moment in this body. Another, I don't even know if this is a body contemplation or not. I've talked about the sound of silence, the sound of spaciousness. Maybe some of you have had that experience. Who's had the experience of sound of silence? Okay, so some of you, good. It usually happens in deep meditation, and you will hear a cosmic hum. And once you hear it, you never stop hearing it again. That could be the downside of it. But it's always there. And it's also a wonderful meditation place. Ayasanta Chitanaya Nandabodhi say it's the place of spaciousness. And so that can be used. I say I'm not sure if it's the body or not, because I'm not sure where it's coming from. You know, I'd like to say ears, but I don't think it's ears, because you would all be hearing it right now, and you're not. But play around with that. You know, just be quiet and just listen. And you might start hearing it. And it's really a gratifying experience. Another thing to keep in mind, and why the present is so important, I just said it before, the past is gone and the future is yet to be. We are only here now, right now, and now, and now, and now. So this isn't particular just to Buddhist thought. If any of you have heard of the Stoics or the Epicureans, they also believed in staying in the present moment. This is a quote from Marcus Aurelius. If you separate from everything you have done in the past, everything that disturbs you about the future, and apply yourself to living the life that you are living, that is to say the present, you can live all the time that remains to you unto your death in calm benevolence and serenity. So this is, you know, not a Buddhist secret. It's been known how powerful being in the present is. Another way to be present is to start cultivating joy and gratitude. I see Susan Orr once a week, as I know some of you do, and, you know, just love spending some time with her as, you know, she's dealing with her cancer diagnosis. And I think I've mentioned this. She has a beautiful gratitude jar. Not only a gratitude jar where she puts in what she's grateful for every day and fills this jar up, so she's got years of them. She also has a friend that every morning they write what they're grateful for each other, and that's how they start the day. What a grounding practice. You know, what a great way to start the day, to be with somebody who is grateful and you're grateful, and you're speaking about it to each other. This is also, I'm going to go back and forth, this is mundane practice. The Buddha also talked about supra-mundane practice, the practice of actually wanting to achieve nibbana. And he said that that is the unconditioned joy. I'm talking about gratitude and joy in our daily life and, you know, the bird singing and sun shining and all of that. Unconditioned happiness is not based on anything. The happiest mind, he said, is the non-attached one. And when asked how there could be bliss in nibbana, since there are no lovely sights or sounds or anything, Sariputta, the Buddhist chief disciple, said that there is no sensation itself is happiness. Some of you might have had this experience briefly. This is the reason people look for achieving jhana, which I'll go into in a little bit, because there is deep, unconditioned happiness. It doesn't last, but it gives some insight into what is possible. And I was reading more about this the other day, and they said it also gives some relief from suffering. You know, sitting and being with this constant impermanence can be sometimes devastating. And jhanic states give you relief to have unconditioned happiness. It is the permanent unconditioned state. It's the only permanent thing there is. This one is going to sound strange, but having taught this course for many, many times, is mindfulness of death. Mindfulness of death, the Buddha said in the Maranasati Sutta, you should be mindful of death with every breath. Well, that might be a little much, you know, just death, 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 death. That could be a little much. But being mindful of it amazingly causes such happiness. When I taught, I taught A Year to Live for 4 years, and the course had three aspects to it. One, to get over your fear of death. One, to have a good death yourself. And the other was to experience joy in this lifetime. And people did. And I've told this story before. One couple signed up for the course, and I knew the wife did not want to take it. The husband said that she had had so much trauma around death that, you know, she just wanted no part of the subject. But he brought her anyway. Not always good, but that's what happened. And after a year, not only was she comfortable with death and talking about it, she is now a hospice volunteer because she got so much out of it. And she said it was due to studying death. there was so much more joy in her life when fear was gone. Okay, this is the one I was going to tell you about that was new to me, and I've been working with it, and I think it's very interesting. And do you know Shinzon Young? Has anybody heard of him? Well, he's a pretty well-known teacher. I believe he is both Zen and Vipassana, but I'm not absolutely sure. Anyway, he has a practice, and he calls it the Gone Practice. And his students asked him for a method that they could use to be as present as possible with the ever-changing flow of everything. And he said he thought about it, he thought of his own practice, and he said this was the best advice he could give them. And he said, traditionally, we notice when things arise. You know, there's a thought, we're told to note it. You know, there's an emotion, note it. The more we investigate, it disappears. He is suggesting just the opposite. He's saying, be aware of when it's disappearing. And I'm going to read you his instructions. To practice the just note gone technique, follow these instructions. Whenever a sensory experience, a sound, a sight, a body sensation suddenly disappears, make a note of it. Clearly acknowledge when you detect the transition point between all of it being present and at least some of it no longer being present. You can use the mental label gone to help you know the end of it, note the end of the experience. If nothing vanishes for a while, that's fine. Just hang out until something does. If you start worrying about the fact that nothing is ending, note each time that that thought ends. There is only a finite amount of real estate available in consciousness at any given instant. Each arising somewhere causes a passing somewhere else. Each moment of cessation points to absolute rest, the still point of the turning world. So, what you're doing is noting when that thought is completely gone and there's a space there before the next one arises. That's what you want to start honing in on. And the more you start noticing that, the longer that space will stay. And that's being completely present. So you might try that out. I tried it and I found it quite a good exercise, and I enjoyed it. It was a little bit different. Another reason we need to stay in the present as much as possible, understanding that karma happens only in the present moment. You cannot change your past. You can affect to a degree your future, and that's only in the present moment. And that's why it is so important to start recognizing it, start working on trying to be in that still place that Shinzon Young talked about. And why does this happen? Well, when you sit, you are just watching your impulses come and go, and you're not reacting to them. You're just watching them come and go. Some people believe this process actually, monastics believe this process actually burns up destructive impulses, and concentration and equanimity take their place. So you've often heard me say this, this practice is cumulative. You might think nothing is going on, but something is. This destruction of impulses that cause harm to yourself and others, you're burning them up by just watching them come and go and not reacting to them. That can only happen in the present moment. You are affecting your own karma if you are able to do this. If you practice this, and the Buddha said anybody can do this, it's practice. Now here's a bonus on all of that. The extra bonus. When those destructive impulses are squeezed out, often what comes up, and I have to admit sometimes I use my sitting for this, creative impulses and insight, especially creative impulses. I have gotten more great ideas sitting, and I can't sit. I gotta write this down, because you're not blocking it all up with your stories about yourself and everybody else. You're just allowing imagination to appear. And I think that is one of the most wonderful things about this practice. I think the most important thing of everything I mentioned, one of the reasons being in the present is so important, this is where the self disappears. So that those moments that Chinzan Young talked about, in between when gone, when that thought is gone, and before the next one arises, there's no self. Because there's no past and there's no future. There's no memories. Anybody hear Radiolab today or yesterday about memories?
Yeah.
That was really good. And it just showed what delusion we live in. We ourselves are nothing but memories. That's all we are. What we've been in the past, what we've done, we are memories. And they were talking about experiments they were doing and finding out the people with the best accurate memories are people with amnesia who only remember a minute before it disappears. The rest of us are constantly reinterpreting our memories depending on what mood we're in, depending on what's going on, it depends on so many things. They're not accurate. They are stories. And they're changing constantly, depending on what you're doing and how you're responding to them. So in those moments, the self disappears. And I'm not going to get off into this, but stream entry in Theravadin practice and Vipassana practice, the very first thing that you must eliminate to be on a path of complete awakening is self-identity. This is why I harp constantly on conceit. And conceit in Buddhism is not conceit. I'm so great, I'm wonderful, and you're not. It could be, I'm so awful, and I can't stand myself. And why aren't I like everybody else? It's obsession with self, and that is suffering. Does everybody understand that? You think about the things you suffer over, it's about you. Even when someone else is suffering, it's because it makes you feel bad and you don't want to deal with it. So the first of the fetters is self-identity, and the present moment is the only place where self-identity on occasion will disappear and you will get a taste of freedom. I also believe freedom comes from service, which is why when I mentor people, I will tell them frequently, I really suggest you get into some form of service. Because when you are serving someone else and you are completely absorbed in their well-being, your self disappears. I've been going into prison for going on 16 years now. And people go, God, how cool is that? No, it's not. I'm selfish. My self disappears when I'm more concerned about what's going on for these other people. I feel a sense of freedom in prison. I'm free for a while because I'm not concerned about myself. It's really a selfish thing, but I'll take it. So anybody that has got that self-absorbed, oh, what's going to happen to me? This is, find something that you are passionate about that you would love to help others do and do it. Believe me, it is for us mundane practitioners, it is one of the best forms of freedom I think there is. So this clock says 2:45, sorry. I'm going to finish up and I'm going to read a poem that I think is very pertinent to all of this. And this is by a poet. His name is Steve Taylor, and it's called Forget the Past. Appropriate. It's just a dream you keep alive by dreaming, a balloon that wants to hit the ground and burst, but which you keep afloat by thinking. The past is only a tail you keep dragging behind you, collecting dust and dirt, until it's so heavy with bitterness and regret, it stops you moving forward. You don't have to sit there and watch while the scenes of your past play back, the tragic comedy of your life, simmering with hurt and envy, shuddering with embarrassment, stabbing yourself with pangs of regret. There is no past. There are only memories of events, and every memory is refracted through a hall of mental mirrors until whatever once was true dissipates and disappears like vapor trails fading in the sky. So cut the tail and cut the tail. Turn the mental projector off. Don't strain your eyes trying to see through the fog when the panorama of the present stretches clear and bright around you.
So, Diane, who wrote that?
His name is Steve Taylor, and it's called Forget the Past.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So anybody have any comments or questions or sharing your own experiences when you have been able to stay present? Yeah.
Just something to add on to the gone practice is that for me, I started by paying attention to my breath and that space between the end of inhalation and the beginning of exhalation and vice versa. For me, that is a segue into the mind piece.
Great. Great. Thank you. Could you repeat that or turn around? Oh, okay. No, you say it again and just say it louder.
Okay. I was just speaking to the mental gone practice. For me, how I get there sometimes is I start by paying attention to the space between the end of my exhalation and the beginning of my inhalation, and then the beginning of the inhalation from the end of the exhalation. So if you can just stay in that time, not forcing yourself not to breathe or to exhale, but just to pay attention to what your body feels like in the space between exhalation and inhalation, then from there, my mind follows sometimes when I'm lucky.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Anybody else, any tips they want to share with the rest or struggles that you've had that you want to share that maybe somebody has some advice? Yeah, Miriam.
I don't know if this satisfies that particular aspect, but there's a moment when this practice or this study has a joy of fire, a moment that you just, at least for me, began the momentum. And so when I read Thich Nhat Hanh, who is just one of those people who sees the great belovedness being in the present moment as he speaks it through poetry and through just love, simple words. I feel like it was, I was very fortunate that he was the first teacher for me, because I can't, it's so indelible. It sort of feels, and so that joy of being in the present moment, and then on occasion recognizing that it is our it is such a gift, and it just is a loveliness of that can really support the life very much. And so, you know, it's these things are fleeting sometimes, often, but they're so real when it really takes hold, or when you see that. So,
thank you, Miriam. Anybody else?
Well, I would validate your idea or your way of forgetting yourself in service. About 2 years ago, I began substitute teaching. And 6 months ago, I got a serious diagnosis of a disease. And I stressed on it for a while, as one clearly would, most people, I think. And then I went back to work. And I exactly, same thing happened to me as you were describing in your prison work. All I could think about was these kids all the time, and I totally forgot myself. I forgot everything that was bothering me and everything else, and I kept doing it every day, and I felt so much better, and I did not have the stress that I experienced when I first got the diagnosis. But it even went further than that, because it wasn't just forgetting myself, because as a substitute teacher, you get challenged a lot by students. Because they don't have self-control, they've been controlled. And so when I tell them I'm not there to control them, which is what I do, I'm there to help them gain self-control, which is kind of from a Buddhist perspective, a little odd, I think, whoever the self may be. But nevertheless, as they perceive their self to be. So then I have to practice patience, because I can't get angry, even though they want me to get angry. They try their best to get angry. So I'm losing myself, and I'm practicing patience at the same time. So it's actually the best Buddhist practice I've ever had.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Margaret?
I had an experience once when I'd had a particularly peaceful meditation, a particularly deep one, and I have the Insight timer on my phone, so when the last bell went off, and therefore there's permission to leave meditation, I suppose. But the funny thing happened was it's as if this all my thoughts just started piling in, like a whole crowd of people trying to get in the door. And that my mental image was actually more of as if grains of sand were overflowing into the vessel of it. And I think that was the clearest thing I've ever seen or felt of how the mind just gets busy. But I was also still in a deep enough state that I was dispassionate enough to just see them as thoughts. And it made me laugh. And So I was able to be present with the fact that that's just what happens. They just start filling up your mind, just like sand in an hourglass.
I had something similar at an Nalio retreat, and I was in deep concentration, and then all of a sudden the thought came up, oh, you're in deep concentration. Well, that screwed it all up. So, yeah, you see that too.
The other one is, and it's probably more for another talk, but that dichotomy that you talked, that Bhikkhu Bodhi was talking about the mundane practice versus moving towards nirvana, and I know that as a longtime practitioner, I sort of felt I'm going to choose that mundane path. Mm-hmm. And I understand it had something to do with the fact I felt that I could do that,
yeah.
And that I could not pursue a path to nirvana. Yeah. I wasn't even sure what that was. It's a little scary to me. So, whereas I could grasp what it means in my day-to-day life to try to do the other things. And someday I'd like to hear a good talk on why would you ever pursue nirvana? Why? I mean, Yeah. If what's so good about the present moment, what's so good about nirvana that you would do it? And the, and I simply don't understand, I think, and I'm afraid of it.
Yeah, you bring up such good points, and I would also encourage you to read a short article in this issue of Tricycle where Andrew Alinsky addresses that. And he talks about where are all the awakened beings? And kind of addresses what you were saying. When I said we're all mundane practitioners, it's because of that. I don't think any of us know what nirvana is. We might have had brief episodes of it. In fact, I'm hopeful everybody's had some brief times where, oh, you know, this was wonderful. But it seems, at least in my limited point of view, that as lay people, it's not possible to be in a complete state of no suffering. That's just my point of view. I'm a mundane practitioner. I do the best I can and enjoy the few times, you know, where you get beyond that. But I know exactly what you're saying. So thank you. And good idea for a talk, too, although I don't think I'm the one to give it. All right. Anybody else have anything to say? Yeah.
I'll just make a quick point. When you talked about service, So my first thought was, oh, you know, maybe go volunteer someplace or something. But then I realized my job is service. So I don't think we need to necessarily go change anything. We can just change our mindset about our daily life. I mean, you know, you're taking care of your garden. Well, it's a service to, in a way, right, to the plants and help them grow. So it's just something that I'm thinking about, like, how do I turn my daily life into service as opposed to changing something?
You know, that's an excellent point, and this is also goes back to the Noble Eightfold Path and Right Livelihood, because that's exactly what Right Livelihood is about, where you are not doing harm, that you are causing happiness for yourself and others through your daily activity. So that's, you know, the first place to start in all of this is the Noble Eightfold Path. It's there for a reason, and it goes into every aspect of our lives, including your livelihood and how it can be a portion of a path to awakening, whatever awakening is. But thank you. Okay, so it is 9 o'clock. I'm going to do a final dedication of merit. May our time together tonight, our skillful time together, be given freely to all living beings, and especially those who are suffering from the fires that are taking place throughout our state. May all beings be free of the ravages of fire. May this end quickly. May our air become clean and pure again. May we all be awakened in this lifetime, and may we all be happy. May we all be free. May we all have ease.